2 years ago, Americans watched in horror as a crisis unfolded at the Kabul airport.
There's desperation and anguish.
More than 80,000 Afghans have since arrived in America, but this story is still unfolding. I'm Andreas Martin. In my new podcast, Stranger Becomes Neighbor, we'll find out what happens to these new arrivals in our communities. Who would help our newest neighbors? Follow us at kslpodcast.com, Apple Podcasts, or anywhere else you listen.
Welcome to another episode of Relentlessly Resilient. I'm Michelle Scharf.
And I'm Jenny Taylor. And today we are really excited. The two of us are going to sit down and share a little about our late husbands and also talk about the celebrations of life and funerals that were held for them after they died and some of the emotions we experienced, the big things, the little things, and the journey that we took in those early days and weeks after losing our spouses.
Welcome to another episode of Relentlessly Resilient, where real people share real life experiences and the tools they've developed to move forward and live their best life. I'm Michelle Scharf.
And I am Jenny Taylor. And Michelle and I are here today, first of all, to thank you for listening to this podcast adventure of ours. We have had so much fun getting to know each other a little better, but also getting to know those of you that have been willing to share your stories. I know I see resilience in other people far before I see it in myself. And to hear other people's stories of how they've risen above or had the courage and determination to take one step at a time, it's helped me so much in my perspective and my own determination to live my best life, just like you just said. So Michelle and I want to take a few minutes today. We do not have a visiting guest. We're just going to share a few of our own thoughts about some of the unexpected milestones and effects of grief that maybe we hadn't seen before both of our husbands died. So things like the physical nature of grief, things like the date on the calendar at the 1 week mark, 1 month mark, 1 year, first birthdays, first holidays, first Christmases. You know, right now we're getting into the height of that holiday season, and the holidays are a wonderfully magical time. And the holidays are really, really hard when you're grieving, when you're facing that loss and particularly missing that special person in your life and everything that goes with that. So, Michelle, I don't know, what's your experience been? You're how many months into being here without John now?
Almost 28.
28, but who's counting, right?
Yeah.
That's one of the things
we're getting
we mentioned.
Close. Yeah. It's, yeah. So, you know, it is interesting. I've said this before. I'm not sure if it was on the podcast or not. However, we've done so many interviews at this point. I'm not sure at what point it came up. But you know, I really thought that I had grieved John with John because he was sick for 22 months. So a little bit different than your experience.
So wait a sec. Pause for a second because those numbers jump out at me. I'm kind of a numbers junkie. You're almost 28 months after his passing.
Yeah.
But you had 22 months of knowing his passing mm-hmm. was coming.
Yep.
So let's do a quick math. You're at 50 months. That's a very long time for your grief process beyond just the date of burial. In a similar but kind of different way, I look at that with mine. You know, my husband passed away about 2 years ago, but he deployed about 3 years ago. And so there's... But we didn't know he was dying. I didn't anticipate grieving Brent with Brent because I was 100% sure he was coming back. So talk a little bit about grieving John's passing with John and then how you still had to grieve after he was gone.
Yeah. So, you know, you get that doctor gives you the diagnosis and somehow you don't want to believe it. You don't want to accept it. There's that denial period. And then you start to realize that this is imminent, but it is for all of us. But you still are holding out for that miracle, you know? And then you get the doctor and he writes you a 6 months, you know, expectancy. And that becomes very real. And they're just guessing. They don't really know, you know? We were given 6 months, like, about 8 or 9 months. I'd have to go back and look through notes, but and of course he was with us much longer than that. But at the very end, they sent us home on our second anniversary that we had celebrated since getting the diagnosis, and they sent us home, and they said, you know, it's going to be within the next 6 months. And I remember looking at everybody in that room and their faces. And I'm really skilled at really reading people, unfortunately.
And that's a lot to read in that room.
It was a lot to read. But there was this one medical assistant nurse that was very close, just fell in love with my husband. And she cheered for us when we went to Hawaii that first year on our anniversary. We were actually at the doctor's office on our anniversary. And she went and got me a little St. Christopher's Hope, like,
oh, how beautiful.
Little, like, token. And some Dove bars and some water. And she's like, happy anniversary. She gave us both a set of those things and said happy anniversary to us. And then we had completed our meeting, our appointment, and we had seen everybody. And when we walked out, she had turned around and she was going to go to probably another room or something and saw my husband and I walking out, and she walked up to him, and he and her just embraced, and I saw the tears just flow, and I thought, oh man, this isn't 6 months. It's not 6 months.
And how long was it?
It was like 3 weeks.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So from that point, it was
so
very
our
quick.
Anniversary was June 27th, and he died on July 17th of 2008.
Oh my goodness!
Yeah.
So you didn't.
So what? What was that?
Less than a month. Yeah.
In less than a month.
You didn't make it to another anniversary, but you also didn't make it another month. So you grieved with him, knowing he's dying. Can you talk a little bit about that? I will admit that concept is foreign to me. I see the horror and the trauma and the sorrow and the sadness of burying a spouse. But I didn't know I had to bury him till the minute he was dead.
Right.
I didn't anticipate that. I didn't have to worry about that. I didn't have to agonize over that. Can you, I mean, I'm sure we could talk about that for days, but can you briefly encapsulate that for us?
Yeah. You know, what's interesting, Jenny, and there's two people I really want to get on our show. I haven't been able to get our schedules coordinated to even tell them what we're doing here. But there are two people that were, as very young moms, they both lost a child. One lost a little boy, one lost a little girl. And those deaths, those little kids, I just felt a connection to. And it changed me as a mom, as a doula, as an apprenticing midwife at the time. And I had had a lot of miscarriages. And watching those moms lose those children, and how they uniquely took care of honoring their young lives really made an impact on me. And I started doing this really strange thing, and it's kind of embarrassing. Everyone's going to listen to this and think, oh, she's crazy.
But they might already think you're crazy, Michelle, so that's okay.
Everybody think. Well, I've accepted it a long time ago. I think
you've embraced it. We just love you
yes,
for it.
Yeah, I am. I'm crazy. So what I started doing was planning my children's funerals and my husband's funerals.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
And okay, that is crazy.
And I know, right? And I would do it
Wait, when was this? Was this while John was sick, or this is long ago?
No. This was when
Years ago, I
had two kids only, and they were just young.
So you're going to have to tell me a little more about
my husband was a hobbyist race car driver, and he was also in a high risk profession. And I just thought, oh my gosh, I'm a planner at this time in my life. I'm very much a planner. Kind of reminds me of Charlotte when we had her on.
Right.
I could have gone on for days with her about, I understand when,
Plan for my day and a plan for my life, a plan
right.
for everyone around me.
Yeah. So what I realized is I'd never planned on losing somebody I had lived with. Mm. And those losing those sweet young children of these good friends of mine really triggered something inside me to really start planning that. Not in anticipation that they would actually die. I think in some way I thought that if I plan these things, I wouldn't ever have to carry them out.
See, that's interesting. And I almost think, and I'm obviously not a social worker or counselor or anything, but in a way, I think that can be a tool of resiliency.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Because I think back, you know, I've made it a point a billion times since Brent was killed that we never really worried he was going to get killed. We didn't sit and talk about the what ifs. It wasn't really even in the back of my mind. We, you know, that somebody else is going to deal with that, not us. But I will admit that there was a time on his third deployment, we had four little kids, and I remember at one point doing a lot of research online of what benefits I might have, mm-hmm. or what the life insurance would look like, or what the military options would be. And it was almost peaceful to me to say, okay, if he were to die in battle,
right.
then, well, I at least know that I'd have this benefit, or I'd still have access to health care through the military. And once I could put some of those ducks in a row,
right,
I really never revisited
it. You have a large
it.
Family,
yeah.
right?
A lot
I mean,
of little
you,
kids.
You,
yeah.
you do have to plan these things out. So, you know, he had health in, or life insurance, and he had all of those things. But for me, it was really just like I didn't want to be caught. It seems to me like we do funerals really fast in our society, you know, 3 days to 7 days. It's like, how can you justify a person's life or honor them in a way that is really fitting? To me, that seems like, how can you possibly do that? You can't, you're grieving,
like
you're
we're
in
trying
a state
to
of
cram
shock.
It all in and then check the box.
Right. You're in a state of shock, you know, but, and there are unfortunately, this is a whole nother episode we should do. We should do an episode on, funeral planning and why some people choose to cremate, why if you want to have people come and look at the body, you have to have them embalmed. Like there's laws that govern how you get to take care of your loved one once they right. pass. I was fortunate because I had time. I learned all of those things and we made those choices together, John
so
and I
did. So you
did
make those choices
we
together,
did.
How to handle his
we did.
Funeral, his burial.
So I have to tell you, so not only did I plan out my children's and my husband's funeral, I didn't tell my children, of course. I didn't want to traumatize my children, but I would share these thoughts and my ideas with my husband. And so John heard probably about 8 over the years, different funerals I had planned for him at different stages of his life where he was involved in different activities. And so they all very much capsulated around his life at that time and going back.
So here's my question. When you got to the point of needing to actually hold a funeral mm-hmm. or a life celebration, did you use any of the elements of
yes.
those plans? So tell us a
all
little.
Of them.
You did. And did that yes. give you kind of peace of mind? Like, well, I never really wanted to use this, but I have given real uh-huh. thought to this.
Yes. And I feel like I gave John a celebration of life, which is what he wanted. He never wanted a funeral. He didn't want it held at a church.
You went to the racetrack, right?
We went to the racetrack. So our bishop came over and asked and offered several times to participate. And I had to thank him, but deny him the ability to speak. John just didn't want that. You know, some funerals you go to, it seems like there's this like segment where it's like hellfire and brimstone. You need to repent. And, you know, this is going to get you to the next life. And like everyone here needs this message because somebody here might die too. And John hated that. He's like, John hated going to do funerals.
That's such a great summary of a funeral.
Right?
That's so awesome.
It's true though. Yeah. I mean, that happens in a lot of them. John just didn't like that. And John also had, he was an active member of the church. We weren't super active at the time that he passed away. But he had a testimony and his testimony was very sweet and simple. He's like, look, we're supposed to love one another and we're supposed to treat our fellow man with kindness and goodness. That was
yeah.
it.
And really, like, wouldn't we all be better off if we actually lived that?
Yes. And
so,
and he was better off because he
so
did live that.
So tell us how this celebration of life, this funeral that you planned that was not a typical mm-hmm. funeral, are you happy with it? When you look back and see
yeah.
kind of how it unfolded, you feel like that was a fitting celebration for him?
Yes. There were things that happened that that nobody knew. And so people didn't. So my husband had some quirky behaviors. He ate ice cream with a fork. I understand this is a thing.
So you were both crazy.
Well, he was definitely crazy, just in a much different way than I am. We balanced our crazy. Yeah, so I, and this is funny, I've actually talked about this with some people, and they're like, oh, yeah, I eat my ice cream with a fork, too.
So we'll ask all of our listeners, if you hear this episode, go to our Facebook page and tell us, do you eat your ice cream with a fork?
So I want it to
We'll call it Team John.
Yeah. And Team Michelle would be the spoon.
So would Team Brett and Jenny.
Because I need to get all of that
I'm not
melted.
Wasting a drop.
Exactly.
I'm not wasting a drop.
Exactly right. So anyway, he from the time that I met him, he's always eaten his ice cream with a fork. I thought it was the most ridiculous thing I'd ever seen. He ate it so fast, though, there was never any melted anything in that bowl. I don't care how big he scooped it either. So I wanted to do ice cream. That was going to be complicated. So I switched from doing the ice cream, and we were going to do churros. And the day of, the churro machine broke.
Oh, of course.
So we didn't get the churros either. And I want to think.
So these are some of the things you weren't super happy with at the celebration.
Yeah,
but overall, you felt like it was a
So those are like
minor
details, right?
Okay.
But here's the beautiful thing that happened. So I called the racetrack and I'm like, look, we want this room. We want I can't even remember what they call it now, but it's like a winner's room where they have like all of these past.
For all the second place winners.
Yeah. For all of these past. I feel bad for saying that.
No, John was a strong second place. Hey, man, if I'm at the Olympics and get silver, I'm running with it.
I know, but
don't apologize for strong second.
Okay. But Jenny, here's the truth of the matter. He also won first place in like world class. So this from cars that were also from England.
So
like
he is a first and second place.
He is a first, second, and a third place finisher.
He owns the podium.
He does. So anyway, so the cool thing about it was I was waiting to hear back from them. Everyone's calling me saying, when is this going to be held? When is it going to be held? I get back the day and they're like, look, this is the only day we have available. And
to
it was
use that room.
To use that room. But they wanted to let me know that unfortunately the track was going to be hot and it was their 24-hour race. And I'm like, this is so perfect.
So a hot track means there's cars on it.
There's cars on the track and they're running the whole 24 hours.
So like, this is the most beautiful backdrop ever.
Yes. So we did dinner above. There's a dining location area above the track where you can overlook the track. We did dinner for family and close friends that had traveled from out of town or out of country. We held a dinner up there, and then we all went downstairs and joined everyone who was gathering in that large room. And the whole time the track was hot.
Awesome.
And so, you know, the men were going out there and just staring and just watching. And some of these men had the privilege of John taking them around the track in his car. And they were just like, he's here. Like this couldn't have come together more perfectly that this track is live right now, you know?
So beautiful.
And so that happened. And it was absolutely perfect. I hired a wonderful florist to do flowers, and I chose sunflowers. Poppies were his favorite. The orange California poppy. We're both from California. We love that plant, but it wasn't available in July readily and very expensive. And so we chose sunflowers, and it set with the black and the white and the checkers and it seemed happy. It seemed like a celebration. There was light.
It was a celebration of his
Yeah,
life.
It was a celebration. And so from the flowers to the hot track, we had his best friend speak. We had one of the young boys that was close to our family talk about how crazy and wild John was and the memories that he had. And my husband was crazy. Like, he was certifiable. Like, he built, I thought he was building one of our first little girls. He'd spent months building this dollhouse. And I thought he was building it for our daughter the whole time. He never said anything. I just assumed. And he never said anything to me. Well, 4th of July comes and he hauls it out into the middle of the street. And this thing is filled up with crushed road flares.
Oh, no.
And all kinds of fireworks and all kinds of And it burnt a hole in our street, in our neighborhood. Where
so
it literally
blew
created
up the dollhouse
yes.
for the 4th of July.
Okay, I thought awesome. He was making it for our daughter.
Was your daughter there to watch it go up
yes.
in flames?
Yes, but okay. she was like two. She okay. really, I don't think she would have understood. But
not quite traumatized by
not,
it?
Not quite traumatized by it, but I couldn't believe it. I mean, those are the crazy things he did.
Yeah. So you've got this beautiful celebration of life happening. You've been planning it, it sounds like, for decades.
Yeah.
At least pieces of.
I have to tell you, when I did tell him his funeral plans, that, you know, 7 or 8 times that I'd already planned his funerals before, he would always cry. And he's like, those are so beautiful. I don't deserve something that wonderful. I'm like, this is how I think. It actually ended up being kind of a cool thing between us because he was always so just surprised by the time and thought that I would put into these things. So I have to tell you, when we knew he was dying, he told me, he said, these are some things I want some people to talk. I don't want to hear the rest of it. It's for you. I already know you're going to do an amazing job. So he actually didn't know. And it actually really came together after he died. So,
really?
Yeah, just everything really started just coming into place.
So beautiful.
And just taking
shape. I wish I'd known you then and could have been there to celebrate that with the cars flipping around the track. And I would have grabbed ice cream with a fork on my way home. Maybe I'll do that today in his honor. All right, Michelle, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we are going to compare and contrast your husband's celebration of life to my husband's very traditional funeral.
Yes.
and it will be a beautiful thing. So we'll be right back.
It's the story of an American held in a dark Venezuelan prison.
Then all of a sudden, they all kind of lined up. They pointed their guns at me. And this is the point where I thought, I'm going to die today.
I'm Becky Bruce. I spent a year working on Hope in Darkness, which now has more than 2 million downloads. Find it on kslpodcast.com or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Welcome back. I'm Michelle Scharf. We're here with Jenny Taylor. It's just Jenny and I today, just talking about the joys of funerals.
you must know if you're a widow of an unexpected loss, if you can sit in a room and tell stories about your husband's funeral and laugh and cry. Like,
yeah.
We can do both.
Yeah.
We can have the tissues ready and be laughing so hard it hurts, but that's it's a great friendship we share, and I'm glad to be in this studio with you today. Michelle, it was fun for me to learn about your husband's celebration of life. I obviously wasn't there. I didn't know you, but it's in fact that celebration of life is what connects us, because
right.
it was at the time of that celebration of life that my husband, who was a social media friend of yours, had hiked to the top of a mountain in Afghanistan with a flag, a picture of John, and sent it to you saying, hey, wish I could be there
yeah.
at this celebration. He would have loved the racetrack, would have been so fun.
Yeah.
And yet he couldn't be there because of his deployment, so he hiked that flag for you. So that celebration is what connects us.
Yeah, it is. But you know what? It's also interesting for me because as I learned so much about Brent from you and hear his stories and the mini farm and this and that, whatever, they had so much in common. They would have gotten a kick out of each other.
You think so? You think they would have been good friends?
Oh, they would have been good friends. 100%. My husband was raised on a farm, raised chickens, loved to garden.
Work in the dirt. Oh, Brent would not call it gardening. He was a farmer. He was a gentleman farmer. That's why we call it the mini farm and not a garden. Although it is like an acre, so that's way too big to be a garden.
Yeah.
But yeah, you know, and I love hearing these stories where I'm getting to know John better
yeah.
and his quirky side, like yeah. ice cream with a fork. And Brent did love Cold Stone. I will tell
yeah.
you, it's definitely anytime I see or taste Cold Stone, I think of him. But
what was his favorite flavor?
He got the same thing every time. Every time. Cake batter, ice cream, the sweet cream with cookie dough. But here's what's the funny thing about him. We would go to Cold Stone for years. We were married 15 years. We'd go to Cold Stone whenever we went. Every time he'd get the little sample spoons and try like 20 different flavors just in case. And every time he'd get cake batter sweet cream with cookie dough. I'm like, what? But just in case he might have wanted to change it up, he sampled them.
That's interesting.
But, you know, that's Brent's personality. He was very traditional, very old-fashioned. When we were first dating and we'd go out to eat at a restaurant, he'd get a cheeseburger and fries every time.
Yeah.
The meat, the bun, and the cheese. That's it. Nothing else. He doesn't want any kind of sauces. He doesn't want vegetables. If we ever went to a political luncheon or dinner later in his career, you know, they'd serve the salad. And if it had any kind of dressing or fancy stuff, he'd kind of like slide it to me. And he was a meat and potatoes kind of guy. But
John was as well. But, you know, I have to tell you, John's favorite ice cream, he's so basic. I mean, men are so simple, right? I mean, they really are. All men are simple.
And we're so complicated.
We 100%. We are what make life difficult.
I'm not sure I ever got the same kind of ice cream at Cold Stone twice in my whole life.
Right.
Not twice. So.
Right? Exactly. John's favorite was either mint chocolate chip or vanilla.
Oh, there you go. Yeah. Which you can always find, mint chocolate chip or vanilla.
Right.
That's easy to please.
Yeah. It's so boring.
Well, that's what I'd say. Here's this man I'm dating. He's getting a cheeseburger and fries everywhere we go. A cheeseburger and fries. Again, like it's really
okay,
easy to order, I guess.
But he didn't get a cheeseburger and fries. He literally got the burger.
A plain cheeseburger and fries. I used to joke that he ate like a child because he didn't like a lot of vegetables and he didn't like sauces. But it was very simple.
Yeah.
Didn't really like Asian food, maybe some Mexican food.
I was out with my daughter-in-law the other night.
She wants a cheeseburger and fries.
So hilarious, because my son said, I want a cheeseburger, no tomato, no pickles, no ketchup, no sauces.
Like, and he...
And my daughter-in-law turns to me and she says, are we ordering for a child?
Yeah, is this a small child or an adult here?
So that's funny.
But he was, okay, so just like he wanted to be a farmer and not a gardener, he was not a picky eater. He had a selective palate. He always had a very dignified way of explaining things. And he was so persuasive in his mannerisms that you just took his side. And you're like, oh, yeah, he's just selective in his palate. But the best part is our oldest daughter's inherited it 100% in that from a very young age, she could tell a brand of like a yogurt or an ice cream, without even seeing the cup or whatever wrapper it came with. She has his selective palate, where the other day we brought home a bag of off-brand candy corn, and she just looked at me like, is that a thing? Like, Mom, you can't do that. And Brent loved candy corn and all things sugary, so he would not have approved of knockoff
so
candy corn. But for his funeral was very, very traditional. And, you know, like I said, I did not see this coming at all. Mm-hmm. Brent didn't see it coming. I know his mother didn't see it coming. None of us had sat down and drafted what should we say or who should speak. And when he died, it became suddenly so public. He was a service member who was killed while deployed overseas. And so I felt and still feel this balance between this is a very personal loss. This is my husband. This is the father of our children. This is my mother-in-law's son. But also, this is also an American soldier who, even if I didn't know him personally, if a neighbor in my community had died in Afghanistan, that would have hurt me. Mm-hmm. Or when you hear something on the news where a service member is killed or a police officer, and it's kind of like they belong to all of us, that
right.
Public good, where it hurts me when I hear of a perfect stranger in uniform giving his life for me. And I've never met his family. And this was even before my husband died. So it came with this shock factor on the personal side, but also kind of what to me felt a responsibility to let the public be a part of this. And my husband became not just one soldier, one fallen service member, but symbolic of literally hundreds of thousands who have died for freedom.
Absolutely. You know, I remember this happening, and I was so shocked. For one, I found out word at my husband's father's funeral, which was so crazy.
Like, how can that be?
And it was also 3 months to the day that he was killed in action that he had flown that flag for me. So the numbers just, for whatever reason, it just is like, it sticks with me.
Yeah.
So then I've gone through everything that I've gone through. I become aware of you and your situation. And I'm watching this all unfold. I have to say, from an outsider, I was horrified for you. I was horrified for you. I was horrified for your children. It was so big and so huge. And there was a camera everywhere. It felt like constantly I'd log on to Facebook or social media, news, whatever. I mean, it was just everywhere. And I thought, this poor woman, she's just lost her spouse. And like you say, I had time. There's no way to plan for this.
No. And, you know, early on, I remember having an impression. I feel like it was God speaking to me. You could call it intuition, whatever. I remember it coming very clearly, a thought in my mind. This first year is not mine. This first year is not mine. This first year is the public's. This first year is this community that's lost this service member. Now, Brent was a National Guardsman. We don't live on a base. I've never lived on a base. We've never PCS'd across the country on orders. He's gone all over the world on orders. But my kids go to school at a normal school. We go to church in a neighborhood full of mostly civilians. Most of our close family, friends, and associates don't know a lot of other military members because we live in a time where less than 1% of America serves in the armed services. Yeah. And I don't even know what that statistic is in Utah, but I bet it's even less because we don't have a giant Fort Knox. We have we have Hill Air Force Base, which is big, but a lot of Hill Air Force Base is civilian contractors in terms of boots in a uniform. And so when Brent died, and where he'd been involved in politics and he'd been involved in business and he'd kind of had this network, a spider web of interactions with a lot of people. He was the first personal connection a lot of people in our community had to a combat death, had to a killed in action. And so it was kind of the slap in the face of, hey, this isn't just somebody in a textbook or on the news story. This is that guy down the street. This is the guy that gets the same thing at Cold Stone every time I'm behind him in line or whatever. And so I just remember very early on thinking, This first year isn't mine. And that mindset helped me because there were the moments when I would feel myself being worn down or maybe even bitter, like everybody else is saying how sad they are. He's gone, yeah, well, it's my husband.
Right.
It's my kid's dad. You know, and you get kind of that bitterness in addition to the grief. But I would just remember those words, this first year is not mine. And so we went to a lot of ceremonies and we went to a lot of military things and people who'd worked with Brent politically reached out. And we as a family tried to make ourselves as available to them as we could. And I'll admit, we made a very conscious choice to make ourselves available to the media. Not that I called them and invited them over by any means. But Brent, when he was in elected office, he worked a lot with the media. And his viewpoint of it was, they're going to tell the story anyway. Do you want to have your voice heard in what they say? And he would do that with a controversial issue in the city or a budget matter during council. And sometimes political officials kind of shy away from the news because they're not sure what spin they'll take or how people will receive the article or if they'll read the whole thing or just a headline. But Brent embraced it. And I think a lot like Alexander Hamilton, you know, he made his way in American history by writing, by communicating. In those days, it was the Federalist Papers and essays and pamphlets. Well, in our day, it's media and social media.
Right.
And so I knew that wasn't out of character for Brent. And I knew, because it was this very public nature of his death, they were going to talk about Brent Taylor. They were going to talk about his family. They're going to talk about how they thought we were grieving and handling things. And I just thought, if they're going to talk about us, they might as well talk to us. And if you want to know how we're doing or what I think of his service or what I think he would think of what's happened now, come closer to the source. So it was a very conscious decision, kind of from that prompting in my mind that first year wasn't ours anyway.
I just remember so many meetings, so many times you were like flown to D.C., put up on a pedestal, chaired on I think it was a State of the Union address at one point. Congressman Bishop had you.
It was a whirlwind.
It was a whirlwind. Mm-hmm. And I would see this all going on. And as a woman who was still early in her grief.
Yeah, we're only a couple months apart.
Yeah, only a couple months apart. I'm thinking, this is so unfair. This is cruel. This is absolutely cruel. Like, I was traumatized for you watching it. I really was.
I appreciate that. And at the same time, I feel as if I was carried through it.
Yeah.
I mean, I look back now. So we are right now at 2 years. I look back at that first year And I can feel the moment when I feel like I kind of took off the mantle of the public grief and the public ceremonies. And it was right after the 1 year mark. And I went to another ceremony and we did some things. And I remember leaving that meeting. It had been almost exactly a year to the date of the funeral. And I remember kind of collapsing at home going, okay, now this is our turn.
Mm-hmm.
Now this is our turn. And then we went into the holiday season and then we got started with brand new 2020. And I was like, okay, this is going to be our year as a family to connect. And now we're going to have our time to grieve and we're going to put the pieces together. And then the pandemic came, which crazy as it was, it did slow things down.
Yes.
It did, you know, mm-hmm. so much for travel and public speaking and some of those things, and got to the point where we were able to regroup as a family at home. But man, that's another episode of challenges of me and seven kids at home.
Right.
You know, where we had just been through such a transitionary stage. But when I look back at that funeral, I feel like it was such a dignified event. And I don't say that because it was my husband. I say it because it was a fallen service member and the respect that was shown.
Oh,
I have since now attended several funerals for a police officer, Officer Nate Lyday of Ogden City Police, an Air Force pilot, First Lieutenant Cage Allen up out of the Brigham City area, Sergeant Brian Mount down in Cedar City, St. George area, and several other soldiers where I've attended and seen the dignity that's displayed. And again, I felt that responsibility to make sure Brent's funeral was personal and faithful because I knew that was what important to our family, our marriage, our relationship, and yet also kind of that public setting. So I chose the speakers very intentionally. We had one of Brent's brothers speak because I wanted the human side of him.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted the silly stories of how he'd negotiate out of chores when he was a kid because he was a born delegator from day one.
Right.
And then we had one of Brent's mayor friends speak that knew him through politics, that knew him through negotiations, that knew what an influence he'd had and knew that not everybody liked him. Because let's be honest, even if you're a dead soldier, you're in politics, you probably ticked somebody off with some policy or program you ran.
It's just the way it is.
And then we had General Burton, who at the time was the adjutant general for the National Guard. And that to me was very stately. That was kind of the official piece where Brent had worked with General Burton on a number of occasions and they knew each other, but they weren't necessarily peers because obviously you got a two-star general and a brand new major, but the dignity that he spoke, not just on behalf of Brent as a soldier, but fallen soldiers in general. And then the final speaker was from the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, one of their quorum of the 70 who happened to have been my mission president when I was a young church
missionary. Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. And so that was a tender mercy where Larry Corbridge, he came and spoke. And it did have that religious component to it and that faith-filled component to it where, for me, that kind of encompassed maybe different walks of Brent's life where he was a brother, a son, a friend. He was a political statesman. He was a soldier. But above all, he was a faithful man,
member.
A loving husband, a disciple of Christ. And his service to his country was 100% service to his God in his mind. But it was very stately. It was held at the Weber State Basketball Arena where people could come and visit. And
It was beautiful.
It was beautiful. And the thing is, I can say that not just as the wife, but like I said, that whole first year was just such a blur. Now, 2 years out, sometimes I'll find a photo or a YouTube video somebody made or news coverage of it that I'd forgotten about. And I'll look at that like out-of-body experience and say, that was a beautiful celebration of a soldier's service to his country. And man, that would make like such a great, inspiring, patriotic movie. And then it's like a punch in the stomach to think, yeah, but I'd have to be like the leading role.
Yeah.
You know, so there's that dichotomy of, I love America. Brent loved America. I promise you he loved his country more than he loved me. He knew I love this country more than I love him. That's what drew us together because we're total nerds like that. But to see the dignity on display, not just for Brent Taylor, the man, but for the person in uniform. And to me, it just represented hundreds of years. You talk about numbers. Here's a good one. I love numbers. I told you that at the beginning. From the date of Brent's death to the following 4th of July was 243 days. And it had been 243 years from the signing of the Declaration of Independence. So you tell me about your numbers, people. I gave a lot of the speeches I gave in the first... that first year, again, I spoke at a lot of things and attended a lot of events. And I'd always try to tie it into if it was D-Day or if it was the anniversary of Gettysburg or if it was you know, some other thing, Pearl Harbor Day. I would always try to tie it into the relevance, again, to make it bigger than just Brent and my story.
Right.
This is the American service member's family's story, which unfortunately is hundreds of thousands of people.
Right.
But I would look at numbers and how many weeks. And like one time I gave a speech about 67 weeks ago, ha ha, a play on the Gettysburg Address. And I remember realizing that at the 4th of July, 2019 was the 243rd anniversary from the signing of the Declaration of Independence in 1776. And it was 243 days. I was like, oh my gosh, this man is everywhere. But it, you know, it, as public as it was, I feel like, again, in my personal faith, God helped change my perspective to where that public, rather than being a huge burden, became a tremendous blessing to me because it carried me. I mean, I would stand to speak at some event. We were honored at some event with an astronaut and a survivor of Hitler's Germany. And I'm up on the stage going, what the heck am I doing here? But I would say this is not me. This is not even Brent. I am the face of millions of people's prayers. I am the face of the cause of this great country that somehow I ended up in this position for that first year, where words would come into my mind. I'd know exactly what to say. And sometimes I'd sit down and say, like, did you record that? Because that was really good.
Yeah.
And I know it wasn't me, because like I'd sit down to try to write it out. I'd be like, nothing. But I could feel the spirit of America, the prayers of American people. You know, sometimes when someone dies and we want to help that person grieve, we think, oh, I can't really do anything. We'll say, I'll pray for you, or I'll think of you. I believe in the power of those thoughts and prayers.
I do too.
When someone says, you know, November 3rd, every year, I know Brent's family and friends and associates are thinking of him. I feel that. Mm-hmm. I feel the vibe, the karma, the spirit, whatever you want to call it. And so don't underestimate what your
I have a variety of
thoughts
friends.
Can do.
Yeah, I have a variety of friends in my sphere, atheist, spiritual people that light candles, don't pray, whatever.
Yeah, just and all over.
All over. The church I grew up in, they had found out about John, and I had actually dated this guy when we were kids, and he reached out to me and said, I heard about your husband. I'm really sorry. Our church would like to pray for you. And so I had churches from California praying for us. People were following me on my Facebook feed because I was very open about this process. And when I would struggle, I'd put out a prayer request.
Yeah.
And I will tell you, within minutes.
You could feel it.
I could feel it.
The same.
I would start seeing those likes hit up or hearts or people commenting, I am praying for you right now, or I have lit a candle, or I have you in my thoughts. I'm sending you wishes. I'm sending energy. I'm sending love.
Whatever,
I'm sending whatever.
Whatever your power is.
And yeah, and I believe all of it matters, and I think 100%. It all works.
100%. And I think you just pointed out an incredible piece of resiliency is recognizing how asking for help is resilience.
Yeah.
For you. And I'd done that before, even before Brent died, when I got overwhelmed during the deployment. I would have him post something like an announcement of something he's doing or just checking in from Afghanistan, because I knew that his checking in on Facebook from Afghanistan would remind people that he's still in Afghanistan, which would remind them that I'm home alone with 7 kids. And I knew they would think of us and pray for us. And I would feel that.
Yeah.
And so the resiliency, I think sometimes we mistakenly think, for me to be resilient, I have to be so strong I don't need anybody else.
Yeah.
Versus the real resilience, the real strength is saying, I know I need someone else's thoughts, prayers, karma, whatever.
Yeah.
I know I need to ask for help. I know I need to be vulnerable enough to say, I hate doing this right now.
Yeah.
This is so hard.
It was so important for me because I would get to the point where I'm like, I can't, like, this is scary, or he's really not well right now. And if something doesn't shift, we're going to be in the hospital, or he's going to go now. And I would put out, you know, kind of a version of what was going on and say, I really could use prayers. Please just pray for us. And within minutes, I literally felt courage, inspiration. Sometimes it was like, try a banana. we later on found out he was low on potassium and we needed to bump his potassium.
Are you kidding? No. And you just had that impression.
I'm talking real inspiration because of something that I put out in a request for a prayer, and it came back in a way that I was able to get a moment of clarity or insight that I didn't have before.
Oh my gosh, I love that.
So call it God, call it spirit, call it
whatever. And how simple the solution was, eat a banana. And mm-hmm. I think sometimes that's how our prayers or our thoughts for other people are answered. It's the little things. So if you are listening and you know someone who is grieving or hurting or facing something hard, don't underestimate the power of the little. The little things, the dropping off a card, sending a text, giving a call, praying for someone, keeping them in your thoughts and in your mind. Don't underestimate how that power uplifts, because really as human beings, we're all connected.
We're all connected.
We're so distanced right now because of COVID. And I think as a Western culture, we're independent, we're self-reliant, we kind of do our own thing. We keep our own space, but our souls are connected. Yeah. We are interactive
beings.
We are
balls of energy and light. That's what we really are.
And why not be a good one?
Yeah.
You know, and a helpful mm-hmm. one. And so we hope those of you who are listening, will be willing to maybe share with us your stories. We know there are so many people out there who have faced so many different walks of life where they've had to be relentless in their efforts to be resilient. And it doesn't just happen when you bury someone you love. There's all kinds of hardships and trials out there. So we're just grateful, Michelle. I think I speak for both of us. Grateful for those of you who are listening, letting us share some of our thoughts and experiences. We look forward to hearing from you. We hope you'll go to our Facebook page, Relentlessly Resilient. Send us an email at rrpodcast@ksl.com. If you or someone you know has a real life story that you're willing to share, we want to talk to you. We want to share that. We want to be able to connect as humans and lift each other up.
And remember, whatever you do, be kind. We have no idea what others are dealing with. Have a great day.
See you guys.